Welcome back to the second portion of today's seminar entitled Everyone Matters. As we start the second part, I wanted to begin on the principle of social justice. You probably heard a lot in the media with all these different groups talking about making sure that they have access to similar services and feeling like sometimes there's a great deal of inequity in terms of who gets access to resources, how they're divided up, and especially even in the mental health field, we can see that in different agencies among different people. So let's look at what the literature would suggest are four critical principles of social justice. In an article by Cretho, Riviera, and Nash, they talk about the four critical principles of social justice. The first one they mention is equity, making sure there's a fair distribution of resources, rights, and responsibilities to all members of society. The second thing they highlight is the importance of access, making sure all people are able to access the knowledge, power, resources, and services that are crucial to having a certain standard of living. Then the third thing they highlight is what they call participation, making sure that every person in society can participate in and be part of their decisions that affect their lives, as well as the people around them. And finally, the fourth principle of social justice that they talk about is harmony, helping individuals make sacrifices with the understanding that such sacrifices ultimately maintain the best interest of all persons concerned. So again, those four critical principles of social justice include equity, access, partnership, and harmony. So the goal of social justice ends up being empowerment, helping people to have a sense of increased individual control in their own lives, development of new skills. Sometimes people aren't aware of the resources around them or how to access them. For example, I remember a young lady who was in high school who had never had a family member who went to college. And she had hopes and dreams. She talked about the things she felt she was good at and wanted to do with her life. But she had no idea how to get to college. She really didn't even understand that you had to contact a college or do an application, or that there was a process to even get in, much less enroll at a college. So one of the things we had to talk about was how to get to there. Just because you want to be in college doesn't mean you go and sign up and start the classes, that there's first steps to getting there. So she had to develop some new skills, and I had to put her in touch with what she had to do with her school, with the guidance counselor, and with the college to pursue the goal she was talking about. With social justice and this goal of empowerment, we're reframing even struggles in terms of some of the strengths that people already have. One of the things that's always struck me through the years is that some of the people that we might look at and see as some of the most oppressed people have actually made use of resources in rather unique ways. For example, you've heard me talk in the first section of today's seminar about when I worked in Southern Ohio. And while there are definitely differences among the worldviews of the people in those areas compared to what I grew up with, it did strike me, however, that there's a resourcefulness that some of them had that might be different from some of what I was aware of. So what does it take to really do this social justice thing? What are the tasks, so to speak, of social justice? So basically, social justice would suggest that what we're supposed to be doing is going beyond the counseling office to tackle issues of cultural awareness, even in communities, in churches, in schools, and legislation. So it's not just about the presenting immediate concerns our clients are bringing to us and understanding them in terms of treatment goals, but really understanding the communities, the historical narratives, and the bigger macro and micro systems that they're part of. It's also about learning and educating others on the history of the cultural and ethnic groups, helping people understand their values, their worldviews, and factors like oppression or privilege. One of the things we may want to do is learning to question even other counselors when we don't see them as being culturally appropriate, or if we see them exploiting others. Also, social justice can entail connecting people or supporting people in terms of their healing methods that are native to them that we may not understand. Like I said, remember when I talked earlier about the grief issue and how around the world there may be people with different perceptions in terms of how to cope with or deal with grief. One of the other things we can do is to be part of the narratives that really need to happen. As I talked about earlier about the multicultural problem solving that can happen in the agencies we work at. So advising others about how to really individualize these multicultural issues. Being a community representative and basically considering ourselves as part of being an agent of change. A lot of times, unfortunately, our counseling and mental health training programs have really let us down in this regard. We might have a few classes that have really compartmentalized or segmented the issues of culture. I remember even in graduate school towards my independent license back in 1997, it was basically they gave us some articles to read about different races, about different ethnicities, about people in different parts of the U.S., and it was extremely limited and a very narrow view, honestly, about culture. So again, what I'm really hoping to do with this seminar today is to help us think a lot more broadly and about several dimensions all on continuums within any of us at any given time. This cultural accommodation model by Long in his article in 2011 talks about that there's three pieces of the pie that we all can be looking at any given time. Each person is an individual, so we do need to deal with our clients as the individuals that they are. But there also are some universals that we can look at. So, for example, when I talked earlier about how do we empathize, how do we put ourselves in our client's shoes, we can only do that if we look at some of the things that are part of our common humanity. And then also, the third piece of that puzzle in the cultural accommodation model of Long is that of a group, looking at what groups that we are part of and how to foster that. So every person is like other people in the universal sense. They're like some other people as part of the groups they're in, and they're like no other people. And that the combination of all those unique multicultural elements is so individual to each person. So what do we need as a foundation to begin this multiculturally effective therapy? We need to go into it with a sense of necessity for change. We need to allow ourselves to experience anxiety. We need to be able to rock the boat, so to speak, of we've learned certain things, we've had certain life experiences, but that we won't be limited just by what we've had so far, that we'll be willing to explore and be willing to be held accountable. That's why it's so important to have these narratives with others, to increase our awareness, to confront problems, to be willing to change. to hope for change, and then to bear social supports for change. So in terms of culturally sensitive treatment, we want to match the client's worldview and find what's effective. And this involves everything from case conceptualization, the strategies or treatment approach, how this client defines the problem, how they see possible solutions, incorporating their worldview, their supports, their community. So an example of this would be looking at even issues like spirituality. Some people are on a continuum about where they're at with religion or spirituality. Some may be very involved in organized ways or religion of expressing what they believe spiritually. Others may not have such an organized view of a church attendance, a mosque, or a temple attendance, or some kind of daily practices even in their own life, and might have a broader sense of spirituality, which basically is a capacity or a tendency towards values and meanings through knowledge, love, peace, connectedness, and transcendence. So one of the things we want to do is meet the clients where they're at with that. So that's just one example of one continuum of where clients might be at. Now, one of the important issues that we see when we're talking about social justice is the issue of racism and prejudice. Again, all of this has to do with a client's perception. While your perception, again, as a therapist, may greatly differ from a client, it's important to hear what they're going through. So basically, to have familiarity with some groups alone is not enough. We need to be willing to re-examine our worldviews, our life experiences, and to develop positive views with different groups. Now, one of the things with the changing face of what traditionally has been called America is that you'll find over time that we're counseling more and more diverse groups of people, ethnically, culturally, racially, beliefs-wise, worldview, on any dimension. And with this, people are coming with different access to resources, different rights, different approaches to treatment. When we're talking about people in particular in the category of immigrants, we see a lot of potential issues of trauma. So we're looking at what was the narrative of, for example, a country they fled from. Was there any war-related violence? Was there a threat of personal injury, torture, sexual assault, malnutrition, or disease? We're looking at the immigration process, which can be rather stressful. The money, the time, the separation from loved ones, the redefining what life looks like in different settings in their country of origin here, and you know, the expectations versus what actually happens. People come with a sense of what's on TV versus what it actually is. The struggles, the academic difficulties for children, the difficulties connecting and forming relationships, feeling out of place, feeling like they don't fit in, having to move, concerns about housing, financial difficulties, lots of differences in values. So some common issues we may want to consider when we're dealing with people with different backgrounds is that there may be issues about depression, guilt, discrimination, isolation, feeling judged about how they identify themselves. There's issues about what they perceive as parenting, discipline, issues about respect for the elderly, issues about access to services, differences about generational stuff. And so we also have these considerations when we're dealing with the group called the transculturals. So these could be kids that were born in one culture or growing up in another culture. keep in mind, you know, even for us, how much the role of TV or magazines might be. And that also can be an influence wherever people are coming from. There's something we all compare ourselves to. So when we're developing these multicultural competencies, we need to look at areas such as attitudes, knowledge, and skills. So we need to build self-awareness, sensitivity to others, increase our ability to interact with different groups, realize what our limits have been and the things that kind of trigger discomfort for us. Also expand our knowledge. In general, just the word competency, aside from the multicultural competency, you might want to think of, are the types of continuing education courses or college courses you're taking and the life experiences, are they helping you to build personal multicultural knowledge? Are you aware of the historical stories of various groups, the discrimination and stereotypes? Are you aware of the values that different groups and different people on various cultural continuums have? What skills do you need from here? All of us can continue developing skills, not just in terms of continuing education, but in terms of discussion with others, in terms of ongoing consultation, in terms of awareness of when to refer or when to consult with others, and even how to adapt what we know already to various types of cultural context. We need to learn to really be in a position where we're constantly self-evaluating, or at least allowing colleagues to balance us out and help us to evaluate, so that we can relinquish absolute truths, learn to accept or consider multiple perspectives, at least minimally, to the point where we can meet the clients where they're at. That we're also critically analyzing techniques and interventions, finding out what's the best fit for the clients. Hearing how their cultural traditions, values, beliefs, and worldview affect things. Developing a style that's culturally sensitive. And refusing to use any kind of procedures in our work that are negative, oppressive, or unethical. How do we do this? Well, we learn, first of all, that we can never bypass those important foundations of therapeutic rapport. So thinking of the empathy, thinking of Rogers process variables, thinking of the importance of that, the development of trust and respect, looking about what information about the counseling process might the client require to really understand the roles that are in the process. Looking at what do I bring to the encounter? What does the client bring? How can I support or hinder them? What can I do to enhance my credibility as someone that this client can trust? You know, keep in mind what we do in terms of the exchange in the counseling office can affect the client's willingness to return to counseling. So looking at that, even things like scheduling, some groups of clients with various cultural views may have a different way of processing time, scheduling, who attends or doesn't attend counseling, and if counseling is even an option. We need to look at, as we talked about earlier, roles like the family and the community. What assumptions do we have about influences on the client? What's similar or different? Are we open to modifying our views on this? What does our client believe about human nature, about the causes or the remedies for the things they're coming in for, the views on their presenting concerns? And then in general, just their identity as a whole, their beliefs about that, and what goals therapeutically may help or hinder them. The other thing that is important when we're looking at trying to understand culture is looking at how do we measure what the indicators of success in counseling would be if clients are having different worldviews. So that's going to be important. We may even want to ask that question. You know, how will we know when we've adequately addressed this issue? We also want to consider, when we're talking about operational definitions, what would the operational definition of certain things mean for this particular client? Now, remember I said there's several different levels that are co-occurring in the client's life. Well, there's a number of people who've looked at this and even done some what they call multicultural ecological mapping. So there's ways they can draw out the influence of all these different simultaneous things. So we have the individual, who I am, myself, the unique combination of things in my life. But we also have other systems all weighing on me in different ways. So the immediate or the microsystem, the people in my immediate home or day-to-day world, could be my parents, who I live with, my siblings, if I attend school, my classmates, my coworkers. Then we build out to other bigger systems like our community, the policies and laws of the area we live in, and bigger systems yet, like cultural norms of an area and expectations. The thing to keep in mind when they're doing this multicultural ecological mapping is that even different areas, for example, that people live in really can influence them. Imagine living, for example, in the South when there was Hurricane Katrina. That definitely impacted your cultural narrative if you lived in that area, regardless of the other cultural dimensions. So we have these other systems weighing on us. So there are some questions we may want to consider when we're diagnosing people of different cultures. Things like, what cultural characteristics define this person? How would they define their symptoms? What might be the environmental factors or situational factors that they would consider? And when we're looking at diagnosis, again, we don't want to do diagnosis based on just a feeling or an impression, because that could be based on our own stereotypes and worldviews. Rather, we want to look at the entire picture of this client, who he or she is, what their narrative is. How am I being influenced by the culture of my client? Would someone else also have a similar diagnosis? So we're helping clients through the therapeutic exchange, through the narratives, learn how to dissolve problems, how to reconstruct their narratives, how to increase their awareness of their strengths and resources. That's why I love the solution-focused approach, because it looks at how have you managed in spite of. Having that strengths-based approach can be so freeing for so many of our clients, regardless of their unique combination of multicultural narratives going at once. They can look at, oh, I'm such and such. Oh, I still made it. Oh, I still have resources. Narrative therapies can be particularly helpful because what we can do in the narrative is help restory. We can look at what the client's journey is, the obstacles they face, things they may have initially seen as limitations or struggles, and then look at the processes that they're in or the things that they want to continue at in their journey. Again, remember there's simultaneously various narratives going along. So what we're doing is we're helping them to restory. We're helping to look at basically developing what I call a restorative narrative. They may be shaped by their heritage. They might be shaped by their education or where they work, what they do. People might also be shaped by things like their environment or their geography that they live in. For example, think of an Eskimo up in Alaska versus someone living in Hawaii or in Florida. The narrative of just based on the geography alone is going to be different based on the temperatures, based on the clothing, based on what types of industry are in the different areas. Other things that shape our client's narrative are things like their hobbies, what they're interested in, the folklore and the beliefs. You know, keep in mind we have some clients who really believe in this folklore and the suspicions of their people. Others may think, oh, that's hogwash. I don't want to listen to that. You know, my parents or other generations believe such and such, but I don't believe that. And then that can cause a whole unique group of problems for them. Then we look at natural events, things like weather, the land, the traumas, the things that have played out in the area the person lives in really can shape them, who they identify with, what their significant life events have been. What happens if they allow themselves to believe that there's mental illness? What is that, a freeing thing to have a label to work with? Or is that an oppressive thing to be considered, quote, mentally ill? When we're talking about changing narratives, we can look at how can I make some choices through the narrative about retelling the story. We want to respect the client's story and what they're telling themselves, but realize that there is a possibility for resiliency. So the things we want to highlight in terms of using narrative approaches to help people process pain is that pain is inevitable. Pain is what helps us transition eventually to genuine healing. One of the things I frequently talk with my clients about is the concept of vulnerability. And how for most people, that's just something we try to push against. But actually, there is. There's no healing, no testimony without there being a test, without there being vulnerability, or with, without there being some pain. There's no easy means to some of the conclusions our clients are looking for. So we end up working with clients quite a bit on the concept of resiliency. One of the things we can frame the narrative approaches in light of is, yes, there may have been a beginning. There may have been a past. There may have been things that led up to this point. But there is a middle. And there will be future chapters of the story. So we're helping clients reconceptualize problem-bound stories. We're helping them reassemble new alternative, outcomes. We're helping clients in a partnership about finding affirmations and strengths. We're helping them work through issues of forgiveness. About how to recall hurts, empathize, and choose forgiveness. And then what that process looks like in terms of committing to forgiveness in that process. For some people, recalling hurt may be difficult. For others, they may not be ready to make that choice for forgiveness. That's a whole nother issue for our clients. One of the other things that we're helping them do is through social reappraisal therapy, looking at how they can reappraise the cost of different decisions. So with the narratives, I mentioned earlier that sometimes our narratives may be rather unpleasant. In the case, for example, of immigrants, we talked about some of the things that they've come from and healing from trauma. But it's not just obviously immigrants that go through trauma, but anything can be perceived as traumatic. If it's someone not understanding who you are and your place in life, feeling limited by prejudices or oppression. So how do we help our clients heal from trauma? Well, we might want to work with them in terms of the roles of significant others and family in their life and what that means in light of their culture. We might continue to look in terms of the socio-interpersonal model. We also need to help them see who is a safe person for them to talk to and what would that look like. What kind of social supports do they have? There's a number of different types of therapies that have even been tailored to various cultural groups. One such example is rap therapy that Elegan, who worked at a traditionally African-American college, developed. He found that 97% of those he surveyed and worked with that were African-American tended to like rap music. And he talked about the different types of rap and how basically rap is a form of narrative. And so he used music. And I found this helpful with a number, especially of teenagers. Sometimes, you know, when you're counseling teens, it's difficult for them to just sit and talk directly about an issue. But they will sometimes play their music, talk about the influence of their music, of their hobbies. So looking at building rapport with a client and then helping them to see rap as a story or music as a story or a poetry or a narrative and looking at how that can transition them to action steps of what they want to do about significant concerns. Other types of therapies that may be particularly helpful for people when we're looking at all these cultural dimensions include just supportive counseling. Sometimes having strengths-based counseling, again, that helps them focus on what works in spite of what they feel does not work can really help. The solution-focused strengths-based stuff can help them look for exceptions to the problem and look at the conditions when the problem's not occurring. It can help them plan experiments and tests. It can help them realize on a positive level that there's some good even in the bad or the unpleasant, that nothing really stays awful forever. And if you've done something good one time, you could possibly do it good two times. Or it's just a matter of increasing the frequency of that. So we can go in with the idea that most clients don't want their problem narratives to continue. Most of them want things to be different. They wouldn't usually be coming to us, especially if they're voluntarily coming to us, if they didn't deep down believe things could be better. Clients are capable of self-evaluating, and they can be experts on their lives. They may just need some guidance and us walking alongside them. So we can basically use a success-driven model to build solutions. Again, that idea of how have you managed. Another type of therapy that can be very helpful is that of information giving. This ties, I think, a lot in with the concept we talked about earlier with the social justice. Sometimes the people we're working with really need information on issues of importance. So that might also overlap with some case management functions or referral to resources in the community. It could be providing psychoeducation or information on things like HIV and AIDS or STDs. Things like educational programs and how to access them. Things like housing or job opportunities. Meal programs. Transportation assistance. One of the approaches that we probably are all aware of that is highly recommended in the literature is that of the cognitive behavioral approach. So one of the things that I do with clients when I'm using this approach is helping them identify what I would call the red flags, those automatic, irrational thought patterns or behavior choices that we do that keep some of the depression, anxiety, mood symptoms, mental health concerns going. So things like shoulds, things like if only then statements, if only I did the good, right, strong, perfect things, life would be better. Things like have to's or absolutes. So we teach them the cycle of the feelings, the thoughts and behaviors, how we might not be able to directly change the feelings, but how we can indirectly work with those by changing the thoughts or beliefs, or sometimes working life in reverse by teaching more positive, rational, realistic types of behaviors and small manageable goals. So for example, I'll mention to clients sometimes that we can do the behaviors that we were doing when we were less depressed, when we were less anxious, and then sometimes our feelings will catch up with it. So we help them identify irrational misbeliefs. We teach them cognitive debating strategies. We teach them ways to be accountable about new beliefs. A variation on the cognitive behavioral approach that I've used with clients, I tell them this little phrase, watch where you put your butts. So I mention to them that we don't want to deny the unpleasant feelings, concerns, worries, irrational thoughts, or questions or doubts, but we want to put them in a context. So for example, a client could say, gosh, I feel like everything's crashing down upon me. So much is going on in my life right now. It feels unmanageable. But I have dealt with change before. But I do have two great friends who are willing to listen and walk alongside me. So what I teach them is we don't want to just say the first half of the equation, just dwelling on the unpleasant feelings, the thoughts and worries. Nor do we want to say the statement in reverse, where we're saying the strengths, but then ending up with, oh, but I know it's awful. What we really want to do is admit what we're going through, but end up with a positive, rational, realistic statement. So examples of this would be things like, maybe I'm not sure how I'm going to manage right now, but I have managed in the past by doing A, B, and C. I wish that things were better than this by this certain age in my life. I thought I'd be at this certain other stage and it's not that way. But, or I don't think my boss or my employer really hears me out. They don't make good use of me or value my opinions. But I have options of jobs, but there are other departments, but, you know, so there's options of ways of looking at things. Basically, what this does is it puts things in context. So then what I do with a client is I'll take those rational, realistic, new messages and behavior choices and put those on another sheet so they become like a, almost like self-affirmations. So we're identifying and challenging attributions and assumptions. We're helping a client let go of toxic beliefs and immobilizing feelings. We're helping modulate loss. We're helping them think differently. Another thing I do with clients is I help identify thinking error types. Again, I normalize, and sometimes I'll even use examples with myself of when I've done these. And I'll say, you know, we all do these. If you do one or two of them out of the 10 or 12, or if you do most of them, does not mean that it's a personal thing or an attack against you. But I'll teach them what some of these mean. So examples like awfulizing or catastrophizing, assuming the worst, all or nothing thinking, having low frustration tolerance. And as we go through, oftentimes the client will jump in and say, oh yeah, I do that. Or yeah, I can relate to that. And then we'll process individual examples. For example, lately I've had a few Asian clients. I've had a few clients of Japanese descent that really prided themselves on doing extremely well, but really struggled with shame. And so we looked at the unique thinking errors that they had with regards to shame and not wanting to let their families down. So we'll teach on these thinking errors, like emotional reasoning. That's a big one too for a lot of clients. Kind of reasoning backwards. Labeling or mind reading. And then we'll teach them the cognitive debating strategies. Things like, is this a fact or just an automatic thought or a strong opinion? What evidence is there for this? Is there any evidence against this? Are there alternative explanations that are more reasonable? Is there any other way of feeling or thinking? What would someone else make of this situation? What advice would I give someone else? Other questions that could be added are things like, what am I actually reacting to? Am I getting anything out of proportion with this? Is there harm that's been done? Am I overestimating the bad? Am I underestimating my ability to cope? Which goes back to that strengths-based, solution-focused approach. Am I going to that automatic negative place? How is pressuring myself and others really helping me get through this? Just because things feel bad, just because it feels off, is it really true? Are things really as black and white, as clear-cut as it seems? Could there be more than one solution? Is believing this life-giving or death-producing? How important is this really? How will things be in 1 week, 1 month, or a year? And then helping them look at the bigger picture. Another type of therapy that may be helpful for our clients in terms of, again, looking at multicultural approaches is just offering community support. A lot of times this takes form of linking them to community resources. It could be even training and some social skills opportunities. It might be also accessing or trying to find some supplemental case management in addition to the clinical work that you're doing. It might be linking them to places that teach positive values or embody some of the values that they already have. Mentoring is a big thing. If there are certain values or certain community things that our clients have, sometimes pairing them up with someone in their community that they would consider a role model or a mentor could be very helpful. And then also linking them to things like business opportunities, job training and awareness, child care, prevention programs, and the criminal justice system. Like I said, we want to make sure the therapies that we're using are efficacious, but we also want to make sure they're meaningful for the different cultural groups that we're dealing with, as the clients would define their culture. One type of therapy that several people have found beneficial is that of filial therapy. So filial therapy meaning more family-based therapy. Sometimes family, parents, extended family, community can really be seen as knowledgeable informants. They can really give us information. It can be helpful to, instead of impose our views as the so-called expert upon someone else's narrative, to instead be eliciting support and interaction from narratives that are already in position. So we can look at, with this filial therapy, values like respect for authority figures, family interdependence, and loyalty. So there's a lot of things we may want to look at in terms of culture. We want to make sure, again, that we're using evidence-based practices. So one of the things that I want to dive into in this next section are some multicultural vignettes and looking at how we might deal with some of these potential cases here. As we summarize, we can kind of use a variety of different issues, but again, making sure that we're really tapping into these areas of what culture is. Again, reminding you that culture is a way people do things. That could be anything from their music, their narrative, their community, their values, their orientations and worldviews on various things and resources. So we're going to conclude this portion, and we're going to dive into in a little bit here these cultural vignettes.